Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Summer is here, and the holiday weekend and the holiday week is coming up, and a lot of times we think about all the camaraderie and the fun we're going to have visiting with friends and family, and so much of that centers around food. But at the same time, while so many folks are celebrating with great and healthy food and big meals and parties, there are so many people across the state of Connecticut that are hungry, especially children and families and single parent homes and our aging population. So many folks going hungry, and that's where Connecticut Food Share comes into play. They are tasked to deliver an informed and equitable response to hunger because they mobilize many community partners, volunteers, and supporters. This organization is a member of Feeding America, a nationwide network of food banks, which brings them even a greater resource and influence. And to help talk about that today, we have brought in the president and CEO of the organization, who I was so thrilled to welcome to the new job a few years ago. Jason Jakubowski is with us with Connecticut Food Bank. Jason, good morning.
John, how are you? Great to be here with you.
Yeah, has it been two plus years?
It's been 3 years since we merged the two food banks together and created Connecticut Food Share. So, you know, for about 38 years, we had, Food Share serving the northern part of the state, Connecticut Food Bank serving the southern part of the state. And about 3 years ago, we merged them together into one food bank serving all 169 towns across the state of Connecticut. And so now we are Connecticut Food Share. So that has been it's been a little more than 3 years.
Well, Connecticut's a tiny.
It feels like a lifetime, by the way. The world seems to be going pretty fast. I feel like we've all aged like 20 years since then.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, between the post-COVID era fallout and this horrible train ride of inflation, especially. I think most felt by most people at their sources of food consuming or food providing. I mean, you go into the grocery store and the occasional 99-cent two for $4 boxes of cereal are now $4 to $6 each, and the list goes on and on. But
I tell people the two things we hear the most at our lines from people who are food insecure here in Connecticut. The two comments we hear the most: one is obviously the cost of groceries. The second is the cost of housing, and those are the two things that we hear the most. And I think they're really, they're definitely two of the drivers in terms of why people are finding themselves without knowing where their next meal is coming from.
Yeah,
just because of the lack of affordability.
Yeah, and it's two of the things we talk about the most here on For the People as well. And I know a lot of times, it starts to turn into this kind of deafening loop of noise.
Yeah.
The bottom line is Connecticut Food Share serves 169 towns in this small state. And there are hungry children and hungry families and hungry seniors in each of those 169 towns.
And people don't always get that. I'm glad you said that, John, because people don't always get that. I mean, I think people generally look at us here in Connecticut and they see one of the richest states in the country.
Sure.
They see a tremendous amount of wealth. What they forget is that there's also a significant amount of poverty.
Yep.
And even in a really, really, even in the wealthiest town in the wealthiest state, i.e. Greenwich, neighbor to neighbor food pantry serves 1,000 families.
Yeah.
So, there is not one town that is immune. And I always say that to people, there is at least one family that we serve in each of the 169 towns. Could be a big city. It could be an affluent suburb. It could be a very small rural town with only a couple hundred people, but there are families all across the state, you know, struggling with this.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say hundreds of kids going to bed hungry in Greenwich and Avon, up in the quiet corner.
We have a mobile truck that goes to Avon that serves Avon. They're there once every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. More than 200 people are in line. Mm-hmm. I mean, and people are like, wait a second, Avon, there's mansions. Yeah, there's mansions. There's also poverty. You never know when somebody is one paycheck away from not knowing where their next meal is coming from. And I think that's one of the realities we've seen. We certainly saw it during the pandemic, but yeah, we still see it to this day.
Yeah. And the other reason we wanted to reel you in here before the holiday week was because tens of thousands of young people from pre-K on up to college age have now not only a summer break, but sadly a break from subsidized and provided food resources within their school environment or their school community. So let's get right to the heart of the matter here, because while people tend to really start thinking about the hungry a little bit before Thanksgiving, the worst time of the year for hunger is actually the time when everybody's looking forward to all their picnics and get-togethers and going out for dinner and stuff like that.
Absolutely. That is a 100% true fact. There's a lot of focus on what we do around the holidays, you know, around Thanksgiving, the December holidays, the New Year. But the truth is, the summer months are the hardest for people dealing with food insecurity because, as you mentioned, it's kids out of school. It makes the numbers go up dramatically. You have children that are used to one, maybe two, maybe even three meals a day at their school, and then it goes literally overnight down to zero. So that definitely adds a strain to the system. So while people like to think about us in November and December, the truth is the three busiest months of the year for us, the three hardest months of the year for what we do, are June, July, August. Because kids are out of school. There are also college kids that are, you know, you go to college, you may be on a meal plan, you come home, you're not on that meal plan anymore. So, I mean, that adds to it as well. So it's probably the time of the year that most people are not as engaged. Again, they're at their picnics, they're at the beach, they're going on vacation, but it's the time of the year where we spend the most money. It's the time of the year in which we have the least amount of volunteers too. So, it's definitely a tough juxtaposition for food banks, but, you're 100% right, John. June, July, August, busiest time of the year for us.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the volunteers, Jason, because you and I both know the value of a volunteer's hour is somewhere in the neighborhood just south of double the minimum wage to any charity that gets it.
I can actually give you the value. We have about 5,700 volunteers a year here. It is the mathematical equivalent to 23 full-time staff members. And I am a nonprofit. We cannot hire 23 additional full-time staff members. So, I mean, the value of volunteers is tremendous, especially at a nonprofit like ours.
So, and right about now, since the kids all got out of school though, over the past couple weeks, and they've fulfilled their entire season of sleeping in about 10 days, and now parents and caregivers are like, okay, well, we know we're going to go to the amusement park on this day, and we're going to go to the museum on that day, and we're going to go to the beach, and then we're going to take our vacation.
Then what do you do?
But now is the time to not only engage young people in volunteerism, absolutely, but also in food activism. And the best place to do that would be to shuttle your teenager or qualified young person to volunteer at Connecticut Food Share.
Absolutely. I got to put you in a commercial for us or something there, John, because that is great. That is very well said. We do have a lot of families that want to try to get their children. Again, also college students who are home for the summer, sure, who may not have a lot to do. We see a lot of them coming in and saying, hey, you know, can I give a couple hours a week here or there? The good thing about volunteering here is there's a lot of different things you can do. You want to come in to the building and sort fruits and vegetables or frozen meat. You could go to one of our mobile sites. You could go to one of our 600 partner pantries across the state. Mm-hmm. If you're looking to do something, we definitely can put you to work because again, we couldn't do what we do without the thousands of volunteers we have every single year.
Yeah, and the advantage of rising juniors and seniors in high school and college age kids coming to volunteer for Connecticut Food Share is so many of our colleges and universities now have their own food pantries and their own hunger crises going. And these people gaining the experience at an operation that's been so tried and true and so long tenured as Connecticut Food Share, these people are going to be able to really get back to their campus or get onto campus as a freshman and say, I'm going to work at the food bank here on campus, and I'm going to know the routine because I did it at Connecticut Food Share.
So 15 years ago, Goodwin University was probably the first collegiate food pantry that we had here in the state of Connecticut. And it was kind of an outlier because it was like, oh, wait a second. Well, you don't see a lot of colleges having pantries. Almost everyone in Connecticut has one now. We serve almost every college and university here in the state of Connecticut. Over the last 2 years, we onboarded the University of Connecticut and the whole UConn system. There is now a Husky Harvest pantry on all seven of UConn's campuses because they recognize that, there are students who absolutely, struggle with food security and don't know where their next meal is coming from. Mm-hmm. So, what started as kind of an anomaly 15 years ago has now really become the mainstream. And, we just onboarded a Central Connecticut State University earlier this week. Yeah. If you go to any college campus in Connecticut, they finally recognize that, college students struggle.
Yeah. CTFoodShare.org is the website to go. Students, if you're listening, parents, caregivers, if you're listening, anyone who oversees young people that may need to or want to do something productive, important, and contributing over the summer, along with enjoying their time off, would be to volunteer. And as you just heard from our guest, Jason Jakubowski, who's president and CEO of Connecticut Food Share, that you don't have to go to one of their stations in Wallingford or one of their other centers or distribution locations. You can go right in your own hometown. There's likely a place you can interact with Connecticut Food Share in each of the 169 cities and towns across Connecticut. So Jason, we want to give you a quick break because there's something else that's going on in the summertime that kind of in some ways mirrors the crisis with hunger in our younger people. Reading during the summertime can help prevent learning loss and increase knowledge moving into a new school year. So many people kind of lose their toehold in terms of their educational progress over the summer because they're not reading enough. So our friends at Read to Grow are inviting you to join the Summer Reading Challenge family reading time that'll run the whole month of July. Participating is easy. Just get the family together one day a week, everyone with their favorite book in hand, and read together in a comfortable shared space, whether it's at the beach, the park, your own living room, or around the dinner table. If you post qualified images of your reading activities each week with the hashtag RTGS Summer Reading, you'll also be eligible to win prizes. You want to find out more? Just visit our friends at readtogrow.org. So as we said, we are with Jason Jakubowski, who's the head heading up Connecticut Food Share, which is supporting individuals and families from one end of the state to the other. They're addressing root causes of hunger, creating long-term solutions, and distributing nutritious food through local partner programs in an effort to alleviate hunger. Heck, they're even growing it themselves, and they're growing it in a really environmentally friendly and progressive way. Jason, tell us about the hydroponics program.
Yeah, one of the things that we've been experimenting with about a year ago, our board of directors decided to run a pilot program with hydroponic farming. So if you come to our facility here in Wallingford, you'll see these two bulkhead type things outside in the driveway. And people always say, oh, those are storage facilities. They're not. They're actually farms. We have the equivalent inside those two facilities of about 5 acres of arable land, and it's climate controlled. And all throughout the year, we're able to grow a harvest and then distribute leafy greens and other vegetables that we're able to give to people in need and to our pantries across the state. It's a pretty innovative thing in that, you know, I mean, one of the downsides to Connecticut is, you know, you obviously cannot, you know, grow anything in the soil in February or March. But with hydroponics, we are able to do that. And so for the last year, we've been able to produce, tens of thousands of pounds of fresh produce for people in need all across the state of Connecticut.
And this, you have one single hydroponic situation right now?
Well, we have two. It's two separate units, but it's one program. We're looking at the numbers and how successful it's been after the first year. Our goal has always been to hope that it's something that's replicable in other spots around the state of Connecticut. I mean, if we can make it work here, we're hopeful that we can maybe make it work at some of our partners or in other places in need around the state. But it's pretty cool because, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people in need don't necessarily get the freshest produce that's available.
Yeah.
And this is a way of making sure that they do. Just because you don't know where your next meal is coming from does not mean that you don't deserve the best food.
Very good. A couple of final things in the last few minutes that we have, and then we'll get you on the road. First is just to remind folks of something you mentioned earlier on in the conversation, that you folks field at least one mobile food pantry, but I thought it was more.
Yeah, actually, we have 113 different mobile sites across the state of Connecticut. It's actually three different trucks that go to the different areas across the state. They run on a 2-week cycle, so it works out very well. And that, you know, the trucks are at the same place at the same time every 2 weeks. And it's a way for people to go and get direct food from us. We tend to have a lot of fresh produce there. And the list of all of those sites are on our website, ctfoodshare.org.
As our tips for running a successful food drive, we talked about volunteering for Connecticut Food Share or one of their partner organizations. But another way you can help the organization is, get your entire summer camp involved, or get your entire scout troop or your entire neighborhood involved in some sort of a food drive. You can learn more about that and how to get that food either to Connecticut Food Share or possibly even get it picked up if there's enough tonnage, I suppose. And
yeah, no, absolutely. We encourage people, if people want to donate, do can drives and make cans and donate non-perishable foods, they can certainly drop them off here. They can drop them off to their local pantry. If they want to collect dollars, always better off giving them to a food bank, because we're able to buy more with those dollars. For example, you go to the store with a dollar, you could buy one can of soup. You give a dollar to a food bank, we could probably buy 20 cans of soup because we're buying in bulk. So camps do food drives all the time, and they're very, very helpful, especially to local communities.
But you hit the nail on the head, Jason, in terms of not just collecting the necessary and needed foods for the local shelters or to put into the Connecticut Food Share Network, but the dollars that go with it. And it's important for people to just remember that one fact that you said when people say, well, why are you collecting money and non-perishable food items? Well, because the dollar that you might spend on one can of soup, that same dollar could buy 20 cans of soup through a consortium buying network through the pantries in the that are networking with Connecticut Food Share. So this was a quite great and informative revisiting with you, Jason. And I really appreciate you taking the time this morning.
I'm happy to chat with you anytime, John. We really appreciate all the support of not only your listeners, but just the folks around the state of Connecticut. We couldn't do what we do without them.
Jason Jakubowski is president and and CEO of Connecticut Food Share. CTFoodShare.org is their website. We hope you'll get involved, collect and donate some money, run a food drive, or consider volunteering for Food Share or one of their many affiliates located in each of the 169 towns in Connecticut. Thank you again, Jason. Have a great summer. We'll talk to you soon. Well, we're pleased at this point in the show to talk about an organization that's been doing incredible work for many, many years in Fairfield County in the greater Bridgeport area that has a whole new sheen, a whole new brand, a whole new look, new website, and a new name. I'm talking about Catalyst Connecticut. You may have known them as Ryosap. Over the past four decades, the now Catalyst CT has been a source of hope for underserved and marginalized youth, families, and neighborhoods. Since 1985, they've positively impacted young people, young adults, and their families with all kinds of programs and supports. We're so pleased to talk to Mark Donald. He's president and CEO of what is now Catalyst CT. Mark, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us. Before we get started, we just want to remind people that maybe, you know, have gotten through the recent heat wave and are saying, man, you know, they're kind of getting a handle on this whole climate change thing and wondering how they might be able to make their home or place of business more resilient to issues related to climate change. Our partners at the Connecticut Green Bank have just announced that two of their flagship financing offerings for homes and commercial buildings are expanding to include projects related to climate adaptation, resiliency, and water infrastructure. Additions allow home and building owners to protect their properties against extreme weather events and potential losses from climate change. And especially for you homeowners, the Smart E-Loan program can offer financing for more than 50 different kinds of upgrades, including insulation, windows, HVAC, solar, geothermal, and battery storage. If you're a homeowner and you want to learn more about the Green Bank and their programs and climate resiliency offerings, go to ctgreenbank.com. And now to Catalyst CT. Mark, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Great, John. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So as we, as you briefed me before we turned on the microphone, you're around 5 years at what was Ryosap and is now Catalyst CT. So let's start talking about what I imagine may have been the inklings or rumblings of a desire to change the branding while keeping and improving the programming way back closer to when you arrived at the organization.
Yeah, I think, you know, it gives us an opportunity to really tell the story of what we do here at Catalyst and honor the history that Ryosap under the name and flagship did for 35, 40 years. And with the restructuring, we decided to change our strategies just slightly, especially with the rise of the crisis around mental health in general, but especially the youth mental health, and combine some of our programs, consolidate, but most importantly, integrate them in the work we do. So it's kind of a reaction, but also being proactive in problems that unfortunately are not going away anytime soon.
Well, you as sort of the figurative quarterback at Catalyst, you couldn't have scored this incredible transformation and rebranding without a very worthy and talented team. Give us a little bit of insight into how you and the leadership there at Catalyst helped to steer this mission to keep the best of what you did and make it better while kind of readjusting to meet and pivot toward the needs of today in the communities that you serve.
Thank you. And then I really appreciate the quarterback metaphor, because you certainly need a great offensive line, but you also need to check what the linebackers are doing to make sure the right play is called. And so we approached it on a couple of different levels. And, you know, historically we have we've incorporated direct service, where we're working with young people directly to get them out of trouble, keep them out of trouble, and stop them from getting in trouble in the first place. But also looking at the advocacy and policy lens while we're building capacity in the community. So what does that mean? It means that we knew going in and through the pandemic and COVID, with our young people being removed from the communities, the uncertainty around health and interaction with social and emotional development, that there'd be some issues around there. So we have programming in our schools where we're working with young people who are struggling to help them build skills to navigate their school, their social settings, and their home lives. In addition to that, we're incorporating all the strengths of our behavioral health programming that is working on educating the public around opioid and other drugs and their misuse and abuse. We're working on suicide prevention, which unfortunately is becoming a greater issue, as well as the general mental health and behavioral health issues that we're facing. That, like I said, are just increasing. But if we know more, we can respond better. We can be aware of our own needs as human beings, aware of our neighbors' needs. So integrating all of those and, you know, using the strengths of the communities, but bring in our expertise to solve these problems that we're facing.
Yeah, and I think of equal importance is community awareness, so you not only can gather your team around each individual that you serve, but also do it with not just the blessing, but also the support and knowledge of the community, which leads me to revert back to our mutual friend, Mary Pat Healy, who on this program 25 years ago was already talking about the State of the Child report, which is an invaluable tool for community leaders, nonprofit leaders, educators, political leaders, and others, community members, to pay attention to, especially in the greater Bridgeport area. And this is something that has remained constant with RIASAP, and I see has now continued to become an important part of the information that Catalyst is gathering and sharing.
Yeah, the State of the Child is a great example. As we, you know, with data coming so fast and furious, we've moved that to digital so we can continue to analyze and disseminate and present. And the community is a key role in that. And just on Monday, we had 25 community members come in for youth mental health first aid training. So they now are better equipped to work with young people. We continue to analyze the data. It's very clear, and the U.S. Surgeon General has come through saying that youth mental health is in a crisis. And quite frankly, as the practitioners, as the professionals, we have to do a better job of educating ourselves so that we can support these young people. So, you know, the State of the Child is a key component and one of the components that we use to address the issue.
We're having our conversation at a particularly interesting point in time where you and your team at Catalyst are neck deep in addressing the issues that are, you know, first, second, third, and fourth from the top of news broadcasts, media reporting, news reporting. As you mentioned, the Surgeon General has just come out in regards to issues around social networks. We're looking at more and more communities and school systems looking at restricting or usage of mobile devices. We're looking at federal officials looking at social network companies and the potential harm that they may be causing to our youngest people. And we're hearing from Hartford and state houses across the country post-COVID of this crisis in engagement with young people going back to school. We're seeing chronic absenteeism at a stage that we've never seen before. And here we are, a catalyst, an agency, right in our own neighborhood that's virtually addressing all of those as your top priorities.
Yeah, and that's so true. And as the data show, and the legalization of cannabis, young people are beginning to use cannabis more. The data for alcohol abuse is rising for older men in a certain demographic. And all these factors look like, self-treatment for some of these issues. And it's obviously not healthy coping skills. And I think one of our goals, and you can hear it in the name of Catalyst, is we have to bring different parts of the community, different bedfellows, so to speak, together to create the change to solve these problems.
Mm. How do you go about engaging with the school district and the various private schools in the greater Bridgeport area?
Well, fortunately, we do benefit from the 40-year relationships that RISAP developed, and we continue to develop and seek new relationships. We have a great relationship with Bridgeport Public Schools. We've recently added our restorative practices training to Fairfield Public Schools, and are constantly bringing in different stakeholders to these training sessions and spread the gospel for stuff that works. I think that's the beauty of having access to more data than ever, is we can show that reducing suspensions is possible through a restorative practice approach, and our young people are better able to handle these skills, learn from their mistakes, restore the harm that they've caused. And it really works from a long-term lens and breaks that school-to-prison pipeline. So I think it's really using our advocacy lens, using our data lens, and our direct service lens, learning what works, showcasing what works, learning what doesn't, and being transparent about what doesn't, so we can learn to solve these problems together.
The other component that we didn't talk about is embodied in the Park City Career Pathways program, and that is creating opportunities for young people to get trained and integrated into not just the workforce at the sort of minimum wage service industry level, but we have commercial, industrial, manufacturing, and other partners who are elbowing at each other for a place at the table to be able to access these future workforce members for real career building, well-paying, well-benefited jobs right here in Fairfield County.
Yeah, and the Park City Career Pathways is a great example of what we do here at Catalyst, is that we learned that the workforce development programs that had worked for so many years don't seem to be working for the programs or for the young people that we have now. They don't know some of these jobs that exist right in their backyard that pay, career living wages that support a family with, as you said, solid benefits and retirement plans. So they're not even aware that these jobs exist. So in order to fill a need for our business community, we created this program, and now we're able to expose young people to opportunities they didn't know. And on the backs of the Unspoken Crisis Report commissioned by the Dalio Foundation, the business community is realizing that, we've got almost 100,000 unfilled jobs that our industry needs, and we've got young people who don't know these jobs exist. So naturally, there's a good fit here, but we have to work better to, do a better job marketing and educating our young people that these are options, and get them something that they're interested in. We all know that many of us have jumped into careers we thought we might like, and then we get in them and we don't like them anymore, or it just doesn't seem to fit or speak to our heart song.
Or pay enough.
Or pay enough, right? Absolutely. And knowing that the reality of putting money, putting a roof over our head and food in our fridge is so important. And if you can do that with something that you enjoy that pays a career wage, a true living wage, then you're going to progress in that career up the chain, ideally. And there are options across the way that, our traditional workforce development just hasn't done a great job of preparing us for.
Right. And I think we've already seen the career pathways, strategically connecting young people with these career making, great paying, great benefited jobs. And in fact, I'm sure just in the 5 or so years that you've been with the organization, you've seen many young people who have come out of these programs, who have already assumed positions of leadership in their community, in their places of worship, in their neighborhoods, and in nonprofit organizations around the region.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, the key part about our Park City career pathways is it's not necessarily that quote-unquote workforce development. It's really a workforce exposure where we guide the young people along their interest level as to what might work for them. Mm. Connecticut State Housatonic right in our backyard. We've been able to get several students enrolled there in a high need pathway that they're interested in. I always joked about the phlebotomy pathway. I believe it's 6 months to a year. You can get certified as a phlebotomist. But if you don't like needles, that's not going to be the best pathway for you. So let's find the one that works for you. Right. If you've got no problem with it, then that's a high need, very good paying job that you can be getting those wages in 6 months to a year.
Mm-hmm. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes. Mark Donald is with us, president and CEO of Catalyst. CatalystCT.org is their website, formerly known as RiaSap. Mark, I got to tell you, I am a regular reader of the e-newsletter that comes out of the hub. So I'd like you to just quickly remind people in a minute or two what the hub is all about.
Great, thank you. Yeah, so the hub serves from Greenwich to Stratford, and the easy way to think about it is all towns that touch the Merritt and Weston. So there's 4 other regional behavioral health action organizations, as they're known, across the state. And our goal is to educate, advocate, and spread the word about all things involving behavioral health, mental health, substance misuse, and addiction. And the addiction spectrum would include gambling. With the legalization of cannabis, with the legalization of gambling, the potential for addiction is real, and that can start as young in the teen years for young people with the gaming, et cetera. So we want people to be highly educated. There's a lot of myths about teens and cannabis consumption, as well as adults and cannabis consumption. So our mission and the importance of our work is only getting greater. So we educate the communities. We do trainings like the Youth Mental Health First Aid I mentioned. We do the QPR, which is Question, Persuade, Refer, around suicide prevention. Vaping is becoming a bigger issue with teens. Sure. And is also not a good thing for adults either. And I think part of the messaging around that has been that vaping is better than cigarettes, and really it's trading one problem for another. So the hub does trainings. We do a lot of different resource guides that can educate communities. I think one thing I mentioned recently is the data coming out that alcohol abuse among men from 35 to 50 is growing astronomical. So we clearly have a lot of work to do around educating people and concentrating on the harm reduction around that type of abuse.
Right. And returning to the initial subject of bringing our young people up as best we can, a program I learned about probably 15 years ago that's been near and dear to my heart, because every single time I talk to somebody who's a graduate of PLTI, the Parent Leadership Training Institute, I hear excitement and inspiration from these people in the last minute or so that we have. When is the next Parent Leadership Training Institute at Catalyst?
Well, we just had the 24th graduation last Tuesday on June 11th, and we start the new classes in January. Our recruitment will start in September, and that is probably the premier capacity building program we have, because we graduate 20 to 30 parent leaders every year, and those leaders go out and become leaders in their communities, leaders at their kids' school, and it really is a force multiplier. And the alumni network of that is unmatched. It would rival Syracuse or Harvard or Yale in terms of passionate believers in the program, for good reason.
Fantastic. Over the past four decades, the organization we now know as Catalyst CT has been a source of hope for underserved and marginalized youth, families, and neighborhoods. And since 1985, they've positively impacted these communities and individuals. As you are hearing, you ain't seen nothing yet. If you'd like to know more or get involved or support Catalyst, please go to their website, catalystct.org. They're Executive Director, President, and CEO, I should say. I'm sorry, Mark. Mark Donald with us this morning here for this segment and our celebration of their rebranding. What is old is new now with Catalyst CT and a number of great new and growing and thriving programs for you to get to know. Once again, catalystct.org, their website. Mark, we'll say farewell to you for now and look forward to talking to you again. Thank you so much for being on the program. Well, several years ago, the award-winning For the People got the opportunity to be the guest of Connecticut's Northwest Regional Workforce Investment Board. We got to talk to a number of the folks that work for them, as well as a couple folks that got jobs and training because of them. The Northwest Workforce Investment Board is part of a statewide network of 19 American job centers in Connecticut, delivering free employment services through one-on-one career counseling, career training, and job placement assistance. Their president and CEO, Catherine Awad, is on the line with us, and we've got some exciting things to talk about, and we'll get into that conversation right after we remind anyone out there who is a paid or volunteer emergency responder, police officer, or former member of the military. We want to remind you that the Thin Line Peer Support Team is there for you. The team consists of members ranging from EMTs to paramedics, firefighters, police officers, dispatchers, and supervisors who are all committed to volunteering their time to provide peer support for you first responders. The team members have all completed certification courses in assisting individuals and groups in crisis on a peer-to-peer level. They're accredited by the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation, and they've also partnered with a team of mental health clinicians from across the state who specialize in dealing with first responders should additional help be needed. If you're a first responder or you know one or love one, get to know Thin Line Peer Support at their website, thinlinepeersupport.org. All right. Catherine, welcome to the program. We thank you for joining us. We know that you're just finishing up some time out of state and talking to us from outside. So we may get a little bit of, a yard or chirping bird noise in the background there, which is totally cool. Thank you for taking the time, actually, while you're away to talk to us this morning about the board. It was wonderful to be able to get down there and meet some of your team as well as the beneficiaries of your team's great work a few years ago. And we've since had the opportunity to have you back on the air a couple times, including this morning. And one of the more important reasons why we're having you today on this last program of June is because application period for folks who hope to participate in the Connecticut Youth Employment Program has closed. And as a result of your team and you qualifying some great applicants, there's going to be a number of additions to Western Connecticut's workforce in the coming weeks. Tell us more about that.
Sure. Thank you. And thanks for the opportunity today. We are pleased to announce that next Monday we'll be launching our annual Connecticut Youth Employment Program that will see 600 to 700 youth that submitted applications in the Northwest region begin a 6-week summer workforce experience. For some kids, it's their first workforce experience. For others, they're returning students who enjoyed the opportunity and wanted to continue with a summer job. We're thankful to the employers who have agreed to accept these students and host them with their work experiences, giving these students and, you know, youth and young adults the opportunity to experience a potential career pathway for them and gain those workforce readiness skills that are so important to being successful in the workplace.
So what type of jobs will these young applicants be either coming to for perhaps the very first time or the returning successful applicants?
Sure. A number of the students have, during the application process, expressed what type of employment situation they're interested in. Some students will be placed in a variety of healthcare opportunities, working in local hospitals. Some will have the opportunity to experience a retail setting. Others will be in opportunity to work in an office setting. And some are in what we call workplace-based opportunities. In Waterbury, we have the Waterbury Police Activity League that hosts a number of programs. Some of our students there will actually stand up and run a food truck this summer. Others will be involved in some landscaping activities where they'll participate in caring for the yards of elderly folks who may not be able to get out and take care of their property during the summer. Also, some opportunities down in the New Milford area, Danbury area. We have great partnerships with their youth services bureaus. And again, the students can be working in a variety of opportunities throughout the region at host sites or within the vendors themselves.
So for the there's so much great aspects of this, Catherine. I guess maybe first and foremost is that some of these companies may be making the acquaintance of a candidate who could come back to them as a workforce member, a full-time employee or a part-time employee for many years or perhaps even decades to come. Getting them integrated into these work environments and getting them to build relationships with these various companies who have so selflessly come to the table to provide these opportunities is a spectacular thing for both the candidates and the companies. How do you go about reaching and qualifying these companies for being places where your applicants will go?
Sure. We do a lot of outreach using our local chambers of commerce and, you know, reaching out to employers, making them aware if they're interested in hosting a student this summer. And to your point, one of our proudest moments is when an employer who hosted a student over the summer chooses to continue that youth's employment after the program is over because they've made such a good relationship. The student has really grown into the role that the employer provided. And we've had numerous cases where kids have then become employees, direct employees of those businesses that were hosting them. Those are the kind of outcomes that we hope for. And again, in some cases, the experience for a youth who might have thought they wanted, had an interest in a career path, they may say, oh, yeah, this isn't really what I thought it is. And so it's an opportunity for both the employer and the student to learn and understand what it takes to be in that particular industry.
Okay. And in the cases where an applicant may want to try to launch some experience or even get some ideas about a career in a business or an industry that is not already part of the workforce board's family of qualified companies. Do you actually go out and kind of one-on-one seek those industries on behalf of that requesting candidate?
We do globally. We do that universally for all of the people that we serve, including our adults who are, you know, coming in looking for work. So whether it's a youth summer placement or an adult placement, we have a cadre of job developers who are out knocking on industry doors of all kinds, looking for job openings and kind of trying to create the relationship between the job seeker and the employer. So that does certainly translate to the youth and the young adults in this summer program. And, you know, we also encourage and do a lot of outreach to employers on a regular basis to create those relationships. So we do try to seek it out. If we have a student that was interested in working with animals, then we would reach out to a local vet's office or to a retail store such as Petco and ask if they'd like to host a student. So we do make every effort to accommodate the students to put them in an industry that they're interested in.
Excellent. Speaking of interesting work, you also played a role in getting some possible future state workers into the pipeline at the DEEP. Let's hear about that partnership.
Yes, certainly. Thank you. We recently successfully completed a training program for seasonal maintainers that was done in conjunction with the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. We had 19 individuals begin the program and 18 completed, which is a very good success rate. And they received multiple industry recognized credentials and training that were associated with working in our state park system. The DEEP facilitated such training, such as awareness of the invasive species, both aquatic invasive species in the water, terrestrial types of weeds that are growing, and so that these men and women, when they complete the hire process, will be well-oiled and well-versed in this, what's needed to keep our parks clean and safe this summer, updating trails, cleaning out trails, just your basic state park maintenance.
Sure.
So we're very excited about that. Was really a successful, and we're very appreciative of the Department of Environmental Protection. Commissioner Dykes was very helpful in getting that going.
Yes, well, as Commissioner Dykes herself has told us on this program, and as we've heard from a number of other sources, there has been an explosion of interest in Connecticut's parks and a massive increase in the amount of people using them. Of course, with the advent of free admission to state parks with your with the fee that is included in your driver's license, this is also helping to boost attendance. And since Connecticut's number one destination for travelers is for hiking, I'd say that these 19 or 18 people that you're putting into the pipeline with the DEEP have come none too soon. In the last 5 minutes that we have with you, Catherine, let's turn our attention to something else that we talk about a lot on this program, and that's manufacturing, getting the stigmas removed from people's memories and from their getting people, oriented into possible careers in manufacturing as young as possible. You folks have worked with the Regional Sector Partnership in Manufacturing, and there's big, good news out of that department.
Yeah, we're very excited to report that our Regional Sector Partnership in Manufacturing continues to make great strides in meeting the needs of the industry. We have successfully secured from the Bond Commission a $300,000 allocation that holds the key to the last piece of putting together a training program for the metal finishing industry. That funding will support a self-contained electroplating line that will be used to implement a training program that was designed by the metal finishing industry leaders themselves, recognizing that there was no formal curriculum for this type of training. This is actually, we're excited, the first in the nation metal finishing industry curriculum. And so we'll be looking to bring entry-level participants to this training program and see them employed by a number of area and statewide metal finishers throughout the state. So we're very excited about that. Again, our manufacturing sector partnership has other programs it's doing besides the metal finishing industry. And another one is that the outreach to high schoolers to explain to them, as you pointed early on, that manufacturing is significantly different than it used to be when their parents or grandparents were working. That dirty, dark, and dangerous moniker is no more. And it's very high tech, very clean, and very precision oriented. So we're happy to be able to educate the future workforce about the availability of good, high-paying jobs in manufacturing.
Yeah, we never our Connecticut chief manufacturing officer Paul would not be happy with me if I didn't remind folks that on any given day here in Connecticut, there's an excess of 3,000 open manufacturing jobs. And Catherine, I'll let you affirm that some of these young people that get into these programs right out of high school, by the time they hit 19 and 20 years old, they're making paychecks in excess of, what would you say?
I'd say in excess of $70,000 or $80,000 a year.
And no shortage of opportunities with companies with these companies that continue to pay for continuing education. They continue to pay for advanced degrees. They continue to provide other benefits, fantastic health benefits, vacations, all kinds of great opportunities in Connecticut's manufacturing and advanced manufacturing sector. And as a result of this bonding, the ability to train on the newest state-of-the-art equipment that is poised to be installed?
Yeah, I mean, the opportunities are endless. We continue to work with industry. I mean, as workforce professionals, we know what we need to hear from industry, what they need to be competitive and keep the workforce that they need. So the fact that these regional sector partnerships are engaging with high-level industry leaders just sets the stage for success. And, you know, we encourage other manufacturers that might not have participated with us in the past to join us. We'll be hosting a very large meeting in September to move that partnership forward. So again, lots of benefits to participating, very little downside to an employer to at least listen into some of the work that we're doing and join in if they find it beneficial.
Fantastic. Catherine Awad is president and CEO of the Northwest Regional Workforce Investment Board. By partnering with businesses on career training and with local governments and training providers, as well as human services agencies, they provide valuable services to adults and youth. Their centers are conveniently located in Waterbury, Danbury, and Torrington. They're part of a statewide network of 19 American Job Centers in Connecticut, delivering free employment services through one-on-one career counseling, career training, and job placement assistance. They have a long name, but a beautifully succinct web handle, nrwib.org. That's nrwib.org. Check them out. If you live in Western Connecticut, you may find a new career or your first job that'll be a lifelong career as a result of this agency. And Catherine, thank you so much for being part of the show this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs John Voquette. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.